Oh my gosh, our plate in time has landed in 1946. It is so crazy that it's going into the 40s, right after World War II. If you want to get all the recipes from this episode, make sure that you sign up for our newsletter. Go to culinaryconvo.com, go to the middle of our homepage and sign up. Either that or just drop us a line at our email. We can get you signed up. That is at culinaryconvopod@gmail.com. And plate and time, I tell you what, it is just getting more and more interesting seeing where all these things are happening and why it's happening. But I would love to hear any of the things that are coming on your neck of the woods during those years, whether it was a birth or a food item that you loved, whatever it may be. Just make sure that, like I said, drop us a line at culinaryconvopod@gmail.com. Make sure you go to culinaryconvo.com, sign up for the newsletter so you can get the Pinterest recipes. You can see what episodes are coming up in the future and all of our great little research tidbits that we come up with. It's kind of like, you know, a dog sitting at the end of a table, you know, and then they're waiting for just food to drop. I drop a lot. So you would be more than excited to check that out. And I know I would be. But we will move on to plate and time in 1946 after a word from our sponsor. Welcome to Culinary Convo. I am your host, Devin Ream. The coffee is poured and your spot at the table is open. I've got my mise en place. And if your mind is open, let us begin. Hey everybody, welcome to Plate in Time. We're in the 1940s. Oh my god, look, my wife.
I'm here.
Oh my god, we made it.
He picked me up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the Plate in Time plate, as you can see, over here-ish, like right there, if you're watching on video, it's like over here-ish. Yeah. If you can see my hand even. I have no idea.
I don't know what's going on with him. I'm going to edit
this in post. Anyway, we're in 1946. So it's after World War II.
Mm-hmm.
Anything you know that's like super impressive about 1946?
I mean, not off the top of my head.
Yeah, me neither.
I just know that it's literally 1 year after World War II ended.
Yeah.
Everybody's trying to recover, recoup from all the bad things that happened.
Right.
So, but yeah, I know, you know, with bad things that happen can come good things.
Yeah.
Or good changes.
Yeah.
So it'll be interesting to see, like, what happened. What people, because, you know, a lot of people had to start over. Or, like, they've, you know.
Yeah.
Yep, you know. You were there.
I wasn't there. Not that old. But, yeah, Hitler's dead. Mussolini,
that's very
gone.
Good. Mm-hmm.
Hirohito, I think he still was around. They just, you know, yeah.
I can't remember.
Americans, we dropped the bomb already. 45. Not good. But anyways, we, you know, 1946, we're talking about the food.
Yeah, we're not.
Yeah, what's going on?
We're not going to go into history, very terrible, awful things.
Actually, I do have a cool fact about 46.
Okay.
No idea if the election occurred in 46. I can't remember. Anyway, Harry S. Truman from Missouri. Yeah, the buck stops here. Yeah, he came up with that. He was small. Glasses. Harry S. Truman,
like,
everybody.
Height?
Yeah, he was short. He was short.
How short?
I can't remember, to be honest with you, but he wasn't very tall. He was a short, little,
like,
scrawny guy.
Well, I don't know. There's kind of shorter for a male, and then there's
the
like,
time.
Whoa.
Right. Like, yeah. No, I don't think he was like, whoa, but I think most people were like, oh, that's a wee little guy, isn't it?
Huh.
Like, yeah.
Okay.
He just wasn't very tall, but he was a leader, right?
That's right.
If some people might say Napoleon complex, I have no idea.
Some
I just
people,
know, you know,
compensate in certain ways.
But no, good old Harry S. True.
So was man. There a fact about him, or just he was the fact?
He was the president because FDR had died.
He died, yeah. You just did, all you said was his name and that he was short, so.
Oh, well, I was saying about 1946. I couldn't remember if the election happened in 46 or not. But Harry S. Truman.
Right. So,
what a guy. We're back in plate and time. 1946. Here we go. First one here off of Wikipedia. I did try to search, like, what companies began in 1946? The first one here, Balducci's. You got Balducci's Food Lovers Market. It is a mid-Atlantic specialty gourmet food retailer in the United States with 8 grocery stores owned by Albertsons since 2020.
That's not a 4.
What?
On the logo? It says above Balducci's.
Yeah, it says 1960.
Yeah, what?
Right, hold on. I'm getting to it. It was established in 1960.
Guys, Culinary Convo is a liar.
No. See, here you go. You gotta sit back and listen. Oh, my gosh. The Balducci family patriarch, Lois, an immigrant from Bari, Italy, began his family's career in the New York City food trade by selling fruits and vegetables from a push cart in Greenpoint, Brooklyn, between 1914 and 1925. So, look at that. 1916? Sure, bud.
This You're is in a all push over cart. The place.
Yeah, exactly.
This is not correct.
Hold on. The family returned to Italy in 1925. So, 1916, still not true. returned to the United States in 1939. And in 1946, Lois and his wife Maria opened a fruit stand at the corner of Christopher Street and Greenwich Avenue in Greenwich Village. In 1972, they moved across 6th Avenue into a storefront at 6th and West 9th Street.
Are you calling him Lois? You're
Is
calling
it Louise?
Him. It's Lewis.
Oh, Lewis.
Like St. Louis?
Well, yeah, I guess so, huh?
Or Louis, but yeah. Not yeah. Lois.
I'm saying Lois. Yeah, Lois. Yeah, so it's Lewis. It's Lewis Balducci.
Oh, yeah. I was like, yeah. Lois for a man's name? That's interesting. And yeah, then I read it because you scrolled, and I'm like, that's Lewis.
Yeah, yeah. I'm used to Lewis being L-E-W. That's what I'm used to Lewis being. But like you were saying, St. Louis, that's how it's spelled. So I'm used to Saint being in front of it. I don't know. And then I'm used to the L-E-W.
This is all over the place. There's early 1910s. There's Lois. There's Lewis. There's 40s.
I'm really glad that you're paying attention here. So from the site of 6th Avenue.
That's what I'm here for.
Balducci's is considered to have been the first grocer in New York City to sell premium quality foods with a butcher, fishmonger, delicatessen, and green grocer all in the same store. Became a model for specialty markets all over the city.
Cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
So basically, they kind of started the business, like a part of it in the 1910s through the 20s, and then they had to move back for whatever reason.
Yeah.
And then when they came back to America, they actually had like a storefront, like the business, not just, you know,
right,
a cart. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah. Yeah. A double immigration story.
I love little markets like that.
Yeah.
They're really awesome.
Yeah. Specialty foods.
Yeah. Like, I'm De Laurentiis in Seattle.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh,
Giada.
That.
Giada. The chef.
Well, I don't think she like has anything to do with it, but
I thought she was like
directly. I don't
really. You don't think so?
She's making a lot of shows. She's going a lot of places.
Yeah, maybe.
Anyway,
I thought she was part of it. I thought she was like owner.
I don't know, but I love it there.
Yeah,
they have these. They're called like CC's, I think. CC something cookies. They're Italian cookies.
Yeah. Yeah, those are good.
Oh my gosh. They're so good. Now you can find all sorts of pasta, meats, cheeses, oils. You can get like sandwiches wines. There's like a whole cellar for
vinegars.
Wines. There's snacks. And there's a pasta that was like...
the size of you?
3 feet. Or no, it was like 6 feet long.
It was big.
I have a picture. Or we have a picture of it.
Yeah.
So anyway, I love places like that because you find really cool stuff.
Yeah. But yeah, Balducci's, we don't know what year they did anything, and they're in New York. So yeah,
and it's really great. Louis was also known as Lois.
Yeah, Lois. Remember Lois?
Yeah.
You should have changed it to the EW, Lewis. That's how, Lewis and Clark, that's like, that's how you spell Lewis.
You just have to admit you're wrong.
No, I am wrong.
And you made a fool of yourself.
No. Because there was no saint in front of it, so there was no way anyone could have known.
The only time say Lewis,
no one
with
could
the
have
O.
Known. I think everyone would have said Lois. I mean, you didn't even correct me immediately
because I couldn't see the screen.
Oh,
where you typed?
Oh, okay. Oh, yeah. Well, I'm just saying. You know, I think everybody would have made that mistake. It happens. You know.
I'd love to go to Balducci's.
Yeah.
I bet
yeah.
it's really nice.
Yeah. The next one here, you got from New Orleans, Elmer's Chiwis. Yeah.
What is this?
Yeah.
I've never heard of this.
Oh, man.
Is that a mouse?
Yeah, it's a mouse. And he's in, like, suspenders.
Is he Elmer?
This is a mouse with suspenders.
I love it.
Red tipped shoes.
I love it.
Yeah.
I really hope he's Elmer.
He is Elmer. That's Elmer.
It is?
Elmer the Mouse. Yeah.
Okay.
Or I think. I don't know.
Well, tell me.
Well, I don't have to tell you because remember, I can't say Lewis, Lois. Anyway, some people just call it Elmer's, but it is Elmer's Fine Foods. It is a snack food company based in New Orleans, Louisiana. Elmer's started in 1946 in making snack products, including its popular Chiwis and Mardi Gras cheese curls sold in various southeastern states. Until their chocolate business was sold, they also specialized in the production of seasonal candies such as Heavenly Hash and Gold Bricks that are popular in the Gulf Coast states. Their manufacturing plant and offices are located in the Ninth Ward, a part of the New Orleans that was heavily flooded by Hurricane Katrina.
Mm.
Yeah. But good old Chiwis.
Are Chiwis like the puffs?
I'm guessing so, yeah. Cause they
or are
have...
they like the first Cheetos?
I don't think they're the first Cheetos.
You don't want to look it up?
I guess not.
It's the namesake. Chiwis.
Here, we'll go to images.
So, yeah.
Elmer's Chiwis.
They're Cheetos.
Yeah, they're basically Cheetos.
They're Cheetos. They were the first Cheetos, I bet.
Hold on. When did Cheetos come out, though?
Not before Chiwis.
I think they did.
Do you like Chiwis versus Cheetos?
Chiwis
versus Cheetos. Friday night at 8. You're in images.
I know,
janitor that made Cheetos.
Oh, Cheetos was invented in 1948.
I told you.
Oh, by Fritos creator Charles Elmer Doolin.
Is this the same guy?
There's no.
This is the research you need to do.
Most people would have just said, oh, look, a mouse and Chiwis. So, let's see.
Well, you know, you got an animal with, like, cheese snack.
Right, one's a cheetah, one's a mouse.
Someone steals from the other, it's guaranteed.
Oh, my gosh. So, Cheetos was a contributing factor in the merger of the Lay Company and the Frito Company. Here we go. Cheetos was invented in 1948, Dallas, Texas. So not crazy far from New Orleans.
I think there's a conspiracy theory going on.
Yeah.
This guy's middle name was Elmer. Elmer's Chiwis came out 2 years before.
Okay, hold on here. So it says here in the history, this is all Wikipedia, so it could be completely wrong. but it says, while Cheetos was the first snack food of its kind, competing products in the snack food category have since emerged. Oh, really? Because we've got one from 46, bub.
Yeah.
Yeah. But anyways, it says Hers Cheese Curls, Wise Cheese Doodles, along with Planters Cheese Puffs, Cheese Curls. Yeah. Talking about Chewies. Good old Elmer's Chewies. Yeah, they're not talking
this
about it.
This is the news we all want to know. This is the history we need in our history books. Okay?
Yeah, I don't know.
But tell me more about Chester. Sorry, not Chester. I was thinking.
Wow.
Chester Cheetah.
Tell me more about this Chester Cheetah.
No, tell me more about Elmer's.
That's it. That's all. Oh, that was it. That's all I got.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I felt bad if I would have like derailed that, but
no. Just Elmer's. They got flooded by Katrina. Wow. They were the first Cheeto chip, but you know, Cheetos is a bigger company. They get more money.
That's so sad.
Oh, is it? That is kind of sad. Funny. I'm kidding.
Well, they clearly started this, and they don't get credit.
I think they get credit. It just, I mean, you know, I bet there were family
They're not
recipes.
As worldwide as Cheetos.
Well, no, because Cheetos is part of Frito-Lay. Elmer didn't collect his Chewies and didn't go to Frito
and
or
And then he
Lay.
Let some other Elmer make his own Chewies.
Yeah, yeah. So I this don't know what to
terrible.
Tell you. Yeah, this is
poor Elmer.
I know.
Poor Mouse.
I know. But the next one here, another manufacturer of snacks, Hers.
Now I've heard of Hers.
Yeah.
Heard of Hers.
Yeah, yeah. They're an American brand of potato chips and other snack foods produced and marketed by eponymous. That's eponymous, correct?
I think so.
Yeah, yeah.
Eponyma.
Eponymous. Private American company, Her Foods, based in Nottingham, Pennsylvania. While their products are sold primarily throughout the eastern United States and Canada, their stronghold in the mid-Atlantic region. Her's products are sold in all 50 American states and in over 40 countries.
Wow.
Yeah. In 1946, Jim Her, then 21 years old, purchased a small potato chip company in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. Initial sales average approximately $30 a week, $417 today, adjusted for inflation.
Could you imagine being 21 right now,
yeah.
like
yeah.
almost 80 years ago, and you just bought a chip company.
Yeah, you just buy a chip company. Yeah.
Wow.
In 1958, the company introduced flavored potato chips, and in 1974, switched to foil packaging from the traditional glassine bags. Mm. The 1970s and 80s saw growth in the snack food industry, which prompted an expansion in the variety of products, including corn chips, tortilla chips, and pretzels. The 80s also saw the addition of the Her Angus farm, a cattle farm which made use of potato waste products.
Huh.
And then Hers was like, you know, we could make beef jerky.
Yeah.
Didn't say that they did, but, oh. you know, they could. They're like, look at it, get our potato-fed cows.
Well, you know what? I like that he used the waste,
yeah.
basically, in another way.
In another way.
So, yeah. very resourceful.
Super resourceful. Good job, Mr. Her. Anyway, we got the next one here, Pilgrims. Pilgrim's Pride Corporation. I remember Pilgrim's being like around in my childhood for some reason. I don't know what product exactly.
I've never heard of this.
Yeah, well, it is an American multinational food company, currently one of the largest chicken producers in the United States and Puerto Rico, and the second largest chicken producer in Mexico. It exited bankruptcy in 2009 in December and relocated its U.S. headquarters to Greeley, Colorado in 2011. It is a majority owned by JBS SA. Pilgrim's Pride purchased Golden Plump for $350 million in late November 2016. Golden Plump is a type of raw chicken. Pilgrim's Pride is a multinational corporation based in Brazil and employs about 38,000 people with sales of $8.1 billion in 2012 and has operations in 12 states, Mexico, and Puerto Rico. They have the capacity to process about 36 million birds per week, resulting in almost 9.5 billion pounds of live chicken annually. Pilgrim's Pride products are distributed primarily through food service and retail outlets. Pilgrim's traces its origins to a feed store opened in 1946 in Pittsburgh, Texas, by Lonnie Bo Pilgrim and his older brother Aubrey. They were known to give away free chicks with the bags of feed they sold, thereby expanding their business. Bo, wearing traditional pilgrim clothing with a pet chicken named Henrietta under his arm, was featured in Pilgrim's Pride advertisements. He became the president of the company after Aubrey died of a heart attack in 1966. Today, Pilgrim's Pride is vertically integrated, meaning the company has its own divisions for every process from egg to table. Pilgrim's Pride is a supplier of Kentucky Fried Chicken and was named its Supplier of the Year in 1997. Other customers include Walmart, Publix, and Wendy's. By 2012, Pilgrim's was the exclusive rotisserie chicken supplier for Costco, supplying 50 million three-pound marinated chickens ready to be placed into a rotisserie.
Wow. That's where it comes from.
That's where it comes from, yeah. Wendy's, KFC, they're everywhere.
Yeah.
Pilgrim.
And I've never heard of him.
Yeah. Yeah. Because you know why? Everybody harangues on Tyson or Foster.
Yeah. And so Foster they like can slide under.
Right. Pilgrim's is like, hey, we make the Costco rotisserie.
Yeah. And they're like, oh, it's fine.
Yeah. $5. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Yeah. They're like, we kill 36 million birds. They're like, oh, a year. He's like, a week.
Yeah. That's insane.
Yeah. It's a lot.
That's like one of those numbers you can't even imagine.
Yeah, it's a lot. It's crazy.
Wow.
So we move on from chicken slaughter to chicken burgers,
woo,
which still incorporates chicken slaughter. The term chicken burger first surfaces in USA print after World War II. Recipes are all over the culinary map. The unifying burger factor means nestled in a personal-sized bread begging for condiments. And it says 1946 Barnyard Burgers made with ground chicken. And this was an ad. And it says, chicken burgers. Barnyard burgers are made from ground cold chicken. If this delicacy is ever left lying around at your home, or turkey or roast, onion and bread stuffing may be added, moistened with one or two eggs, and seasoned to taste. Saute until brown in chicken fat and serve on whopping big biscuits.
Well, yeah, I bet that's good. It's
cooked
in fat and on biscuits. Like,
yeah. Oh, my. It was from With Range to Suit Cannibal and Gourmet, the Corsicana Daily Sun in Texas. Shows here 1946 up there for the Barnyard Burgers for the ad, but then the recipe was in 1948. Mm. Most likely this ground chicken was pre-cooked. That's what they say. The next one here from foodtimeline.org, tuna melts.
That's such a mid-century thing. It hurts.
Yeah. So although hot sandwich-type combinations of bread, cheese, and meat and condiments were known to ancient cooks, tuna fish sandwiches are generally considered a 20th century recipe. The canned tuna industry was launched in 1903, and food companies played an active role in promoting their products to the American public. Many companies authored cookbooks and recipe brochures to show housewives how to use their product. Tuna fit neatly into the sandwich market, where diced lobster, crab, and salmon mixed with dressings were already in vogue. Recipes for tuna sandwiches, mostly cold tuna salad, began to show up regularly in American cookbooks published in the 1920s. These books also contain several recipes for toasted and broiled cheese and meat combinations, though none with tuna. The only hot fish sandwich recipes we find in the 1920s and 30s are for sardines without cheese. It is not until after World War II we begin to find recipes for toasted tuna and cheese combinations, either open or closed, broiled or sautéed. They were not called cheese melts, but they would have produced a similar product. Consider, in 1946, tuna fish sandwiches with cheese from Joy of Cooking, broiled open with tomatoes and grated cheese. are boring.
I'm good.
You sure?
Yeah.
You liked tuna salad when you were a kid.
Hold on.
Nope.
I did not like tuna salad.
You liked
I like tuna with mayonnaise. Don't put no celery in it.
So mayonnaise and tuna. two of the key ingredients you need for a salad of tuna.
Yeah, but there was no celery.
You could have added other things.
I didn't. Did you?
No?
No. I added goldfish. Or Cheez-Its. So, you know.
You were having tuna melts.
Yeah, in a way. Yeah, okay. Okay. I just think right now, because I haven't had a tuna sandwich since I was a kid.
Yeah.
This does not sound appetizing to me.
Right.
But, you know, back in the day, yeah. I was pretty much there. So
you're just shoveling down tuna melts and you had no idea.
No.
Crunchy tuna melts because it had the
cheese. Hey, it was good because there was texture.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was good. So,
yeah. Well, this next one is all about texture. Potato chip cookies.
No way. Oh, sick.
So when did it happen? Recipes published in local newspapers provide clues. The earliest print evidence appears just after World War II. In 1959, the Potato Chip Institute International began sponsoring an annual men's national cooking championship with one mandatory ingredient. Recipes proliferated. The most challenging potato chip cookie recipes to recreate today are those specifying product by price, a 29-cent bag of potato chips, rather than standard measure, 1 cup. Cooks wondering how many chips they need for 1 cup crushed were helped by, you guessed it, potato chip companies.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. 1946, it says, potato chip cookies. Don't put up your hands and, or don't, okay, it says, don't put up your hands in awe because we recommend potato chips and cookies. Crush 1 cup of them. Buy a package of prepared pudding mix of butterscotch flavor. Sift 1 cup flour, any kind that you can get. Be sparing on the salt. Just a pinch will do. Sift it with flour and 1/2 teaspoon each of soda and baking powder. Put pudding mix into the bowl. Add the chips and the flour mixture. Add 1 beaten egg and 1/2 cup shortening melted from a dough into a roll and chill it until firm. Slice 1/4 inch thick and arrange a lightly greased cookie sheet. Bake at 325 from 10 to 12 minutes or until done or drop from a spoon onto a cookie sheet. Flatten to 1/4 inch thickness and bake as suggested. I'm sure a lot of people doing the potato chip cookies, they were like, yeah, this is easy.
Well, you know, I was kind of thinking when you first said what it was, I was like, oh, I wonder if it was like the chocolate chip cookie where that was an accident. Right. I was like, oh, maybe this was like an accident or unintentional, but this sounds very intentional because of potato chip companies. But that's really cool. I had no idea. And putting potato chips in cookies, hello.
Yeah.
Like good those, stuff. What are those kitchen sink cookies? Mm-hmm. That's a very integral part.
Yeah.
Yeah. Definitely need to make something like this.
Mm-hmm. And this was from the Freeport Journal Standard in Illinois on August 5th, 1946. Yep, those Illinoisans. But the next one here, frozen orange juice. Oh, yeah. So frozen juice concentrate, really. Says here, our research confirms Minute Maid brand orange juice concentrate. It was developed by Vacuum Foods Corporation in 1945. Originally created for the U.S. Army, the product was introduced to the American public on April 30th, 1946. The company changed its name to Minute Maid in 1949. In the summer of 49, Minute Maid ran a major ad campaign in major popular magazines and newspapers. Minute Maid brand of orange juice is the category brand leader in the United States with a well-differentiated line of frozen concentrate and chilled varieties. Minute Maid has been offering consumers frozen concentrated orange juice since 1946. Minute Maid was the first orange juice brand developed as a frozen concentrate. In 1946, John M. Fox, the brand founder, initially marketed the concentrate through door-to-door salesmen in Massachusetts. Fox founded Florida Foods Incorporated in 1945. Within a year, the company name was changed to Vacuum Foods Corporation. Vacuum Foods was affiliated with the National Research Corporation, which had developed a high vacuum evaporation process that eliminated 80% of the water to reduce orange juice to a concentrate while retaining the full flavor.
I think you can stop here. This is a lot of, like, unnecessary information, really.
Yeah, it is. The 1948 launch of the Bing Crosby radio campaign boosted early sales dramatically. A label with a black background was adopted in 1964. At that time, it was extremely uncommon to associate the color black with food products.
Yeah.
Yeah. Kind of interesting. That is from the Minute Maid Encyclopedia of Consumer Brands by Janice Jorgensen, editor of the St. James Press, Detroit, in 1994.
Yeah, they got a lot to say about orange juice.
They're
like, what the heck? Like,
it was a lot. It was quite a bit. But positivity was a main ingredient in this mainstay, Nutella.
That's right. Really?
Yeah. Uh-oh, we got a cat.
Here's a Benny.
Oh, man, we got a raging Benny coming.
I really hope he doesn't knock his camera over.
Oh, man, just lay down, bud. Just lay down. Oh, good job.
He heard Nutella, and he's like, man. Can I have that? And we're like, yeah. No, there's chocolate in it. He's chocolate. Like, come on.
He's like, come on, guys. Come on, I'm a little fatty. Come on. Oh, he's a sweet little
He
boy.
Loves Burger King French fries, so I bet he Burger wants King to French dip. Fries. You know, like people dip French fries in ice cream? I do that. He wants to dip Burger King French fries in Nutella.
Yeah. So. Yeah. This is an early image of Nutella. It came in like a little brick and foil.
Wow.
Yeah. After World War II, cocoa was extremely scarce. Ferrero, originally from Piedmont in Italy, turned this tricky problem into a smart solution by creating a sweet paste made from hazelnuts, sugar, and just a little of the rare cocoa. Oh, we got a movement on Benny here. The precursor to Nutella was born. Look at that brick.
Wow.
Yeah, brick of Nutella.
And it wasn't called Nutella.
No, it was called Gianduiot, right?
Gianduiot.
The sweet paste of the recipe was shaped into a loaf that could be sliced and spread on bread, named after a local carnival character.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. Woo! Oh, my gosh. My hair is making me look like I'm going bald, but I promise I'm not. Like, look at it. It's a good wig, I promise.
Oh, dear.
yeah. This next one here from Food Timeline, you got the Stork Club Cocktails from 1946. I just want to go over that they published the Stork Club Bar Book. So they had been around a lot earlier than that. But in 1946, they started saying, you know what? You want to make cocktails at home? Go ahead. You want a war? Go drink at home.
Yeah, like they kind of need to forget what just happened.
Yeah. So some of the big ones here, you got a Manhattan, a martini. There's champagne cocktail.
Of course.
A sidecar.
Yes.
A zombie.
Yes.
Frozen daiquiri.
Nice.
A mint julep.
Nice.
There's one more. Singapore Sling.
Nice.
We know that one.
Nice.
The rest of these are kind of ones that I think have been lost to time, like the Stork Club Cooler.
A French 75 is very popular, and it's been around a long time. Yeah. Since, like, the 1800s or something.
Yeah. I don't know that one.
I want to try it.
Yeah. But no, a Commando, an Alexander the Great.
Yeah, I haven't heard of those. Devil's Tail.
Devil's Tail. Roman Punch. Julius Special. Yeah. I bet you anything, some of these are just called something different, but they're super popular.
Probably.
Still,
probably. Know?
Yeah. But good old Stork Club. They had a book of it. And then, not to be outdone, oh my God. Oh, I'm getting pushed by my cat. Oh no. We got Trader Vic's cocktail.
Oh yes.
Yeah.
Iconic. Yes.
They published their book in 1946. Yes. Trader Vic's Book of Food and Drink by Doubleday and Company.
It is introduced, and we've got some cool drinks in this one, too. We got a mojito. Mm-hmm. We have a zombie. We've got the flamingo. You have a, what is it? There's a devil's leap, a hibiscus. Trader Vic's punch, very popular to this day. Yeah. So theirs were a lot more like, you know, kind of like the brand. It was supposed to be more tropical.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I would love a original Trader Vic's book, but they're very expensive.
Yeah.
There's also, I can't remember the name, but it was like Trader Vic's versus some other, basically tiki bar business that did like the same thing as Trader Vic's.
Yeah.
I have this one book. It's called like Vintage Cocktails, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
And so basically it talks about these drinks from, I think, like late 30s or 40s through late 60s, early 70s.
Yeah.
And they talk a lot about Trader Vic's.
Yeah.
Because it was huge.
Well, and we have a, what is it, Trader Vic's, is it Amaretto? Or, we have something at Trader Vic's.
Yes.
Yeah, we have a bottle of something.
Yeah.
But yeah, they're still very popular
mm-hmm.
to this day. Yeah. The next one here, we're going to foodreference.com. We're switching from food timeline to foodreference.com, going over food history in 1946. Our good buddy Dan Quayle is born. Dan Quayle, don't know if you were listening, and we have an episode coming up. But anyways, Dan Quayle, he was destined to make the potato famous. Do you know anything about it?
No.
He was in a kid's classroom during an election campaign because he was the vice president of George H.W.
But what does he have to do with 1946?
He was born.
Okay.
1946.
Okay.
Yeah. But anyways, he was in a kid's classroom. They were doing like a spelling bee, and this kid spells potato. So P-O-T-A-T-O. And Dan here said, well, kid, that needs an E on the end. So the kid goes back, puts an E, and then everyone in the room starts clapping because they're like, oh, he got it right. And it's like, the vice president doesn't know how to spell potato. It basically crashed their whole campaign for re-election in 1992. And, yeah, became a very famous political gaffe that he didn't know how to spell potato and he was the vice president.
That's the funniest thing I've ever heard.
Yeah, yeah. Now we have, you know, presidents doing all sorts of stuff other than misspelling potato.
Yeah, I wish it was that innocent.
Yeah,
still.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I wish it were that simple.
You know what?
Of a disqualifier.
You know what? He's an icon in my eyes, okay? Because they used to spell cookie a different way.
Right.
I've talked about that before.
Yeah.
You know, it used to end in Y, now it ends in IE. So I don't know, maybe he, like,
yeah,
it depends where he grew up or something. Well, like,
I'm sure for his answer, like, I don't know what he exactly said afterward. It probably just was like, oops, my bad. But, like, well, potatoes.
That's right. That's it. ES. So maybe he just thought, yeah, oh, one potato.
Right.
Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah, the potato.
He's legendary to me. He's an icon.
Yeah. Oh, man.
Yeah.
An old Dan Quayle. Oh, jeez. But another thing in 1946, the International Whaling Commission was established as the decision-making body of the International Convention for the Regulation of Whaling, or the ICRW. Their mission, to provide for the proper conservation of whale stocks and thus making possible the orderly development of the whaling industry. Do you hear that, Benny? You were organized back in 1946. That's right, I called my cat a whale because he's so junky. Yeah, or he acts junky, I should say. Anyway, but the next one here, 1946, Jimmy Buffett was born.
Mm.
Cheeseburger in paradise, paradise, in Margaritaville.
He loves his food.
Margaritaville. Hi, sir. Is there something I can help you with?
He loves the camera.
He does. He's licking his paw.
He heard cheeseburger and he got very excited.
He was like Burger King.
He's
fries?
Like, yeah, that'll go with my fries.
Yeah, that goes with my fries.
My
sir.
Nutella.
Yeah, sir. Your fries? You bringing fries, please? Oh my gosh! What? Come on! I know you got excited. We talked about the Whaling Commission. It's okay. Yeah, that and cheeseburgers. You love your cheeseburgers. Yeah. But anyways, next one here. James Beard hosted the first regular televised cooking show in the U.S. I Love to Eat.
Nice.
Yeah. Good old James Beard coming from all Oregon, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then the next one here, George A. Hormel. Look at that guy.
Wow.
Look at that guy.
I was
going
to say something, but it involves a curse word. But he has swagger.
This man fornicated, I believe. Yes, that is what you were meaning to
That's
say.
That's what I was going to say. It's a different word. Yes, yes, he has... Yeah. He has a vibe.
Yeah, podcast listeners, you need to jump on YouTube. This guy, I mean, he's wearing the jacket. He has a sweater vest.
A tie. A button-up.
And then a flannel button-up.
And you know what? His hairline's a little weird, but it's all about the energy and the vibe.
It is the
vibe. And the confidence.
Right.
So,
oh, yeah, he's staring right at the camera.
Yes.
He's
just he has these massive eyebrows.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, a rugged face.
He's like, I'm George.
Yeah.
Yeah. George A. Hormel. He died on June 5th. He was born in 1860. So he was born...
Dang!
Pre-Civil War. Yeah. Founder of a meatpacking company, George A. Hormel & Company, Hormel Foods in Austin, Minnesota, in 1891. Developed the first canned ham in 1926. Introduced Spam
in
1937. Hormel chili.
Yep.
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 Don't get the microwave meals.
Yeah.
Those are so disgusting. I had to eat those in college.
They do in a pinch. It's just they are weird. Like if you can get way better, like elsewhere.
So I would buy those because they were cheap and I was in college and I basically had to go from like a class and I'd like... 2 hours in between a class and then when I had to do my work study job. Yeah. And so I had to get something that was microwavable. So I was like, I'm going to try these because it sounds good. They're not.
They do sound good. Yeah.
Yeah.
They always
sound good. And then you eat it and you're like, ugh. So that's one thing that, you know, I'm glad he wasn't around to see that.
Yeah. Yeah. Poor George. Anyway. A Tupperware was introduced in 1946. Products didn't sell well in retail outlets, primarily because consumers needed demonstrations in order to understand how the airtight seals worked. Yeah. My grandma had a set of these bowls.
Yeah.
My mom had a couple. Like, they lasted
Tupperware
a
was
long
huge.
Time. Yeah, it was a big deal. And then the New Haven Restaurant Institute... opened a storefront. It soon became the Culinary Institute of America. So the CIA. Yeah. So 1946 is when they began.
Cool.
Yeah. And then the Culinary Institute of America was founded in New Haven, Connecticut. And in 1972, they relocated to Hyde Park, New York. So yeah, they were all created in 1946. And then self-rising cornmeal was marketed for the first time.
Hmm.
Yeah, good things. And then frozen french fries went on sale at R.H. Macy Department Store in New York.
Yes, Macy's work.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
Macy's was
sell
like,
those french fries.
Macy's was like, one day they're going to sell an air fryer and everyone's going to love these. Until then, everyone's going to get angry at their parents and grandparents because their fries are soggy.
I think.
Yeah.
An air fryer would have been, like, too far of an advancement.
You think so?
For the 40s, yeah. I think it would have been really dangerous.
Yeah, it could have been. Yeah. Little nuclear reactor on their, on their countertop.
Would have
been crazy. But then on top of that, Philadelphia entrepreneur Edward J. Pizek, a short order cook, John Paul marketed frozen deviled crabs as the first product for their new company, Mrs. Paul's Kitchens. So, deviled crab. I have not seen frozen deviled crab in decades. Like I'm talking when I was a wee little lad.
I don't know what that is.
So, deviled crab, it's basically
like deviled eggs?
I would say like a same concept. So basically imagine like a crab cake, but it's made into like a crab salad, and then they bread it and fry it in a ball. And then they try to make it look like a crab shell, kind of, sort of.
Okay.
It was an odd little thing.
I'm fine with my crab cakes.
I think it's an East Coast thing still. Like, yeah. But anyways. And then French's, they did instant mashed potatoes.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
Saved you from boiling your taters.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But yeah, French's instant mashed potatoes. And then the cocktail, Moscow Mule.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, was created. Smirnoff vodka and ginger beer in a copper mug.
Yeah.
Which they tell you not to drink out of anymore because it does something. Something about the copper mug.
It like, there's like, don't take my word for this. There's like lead in it or something. Yeah, or some weird. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway.
You can't enjoy your life.
Yeah, you can't have anything fun. Brennan's restaurant opens on Royal Street in the French Quarter of New Orleans. Yeah. Why is Brennan's restaurant so famous? Well, when Owen Brennan, the beloved proprietor of the old Absinthe House, was teased by Count Arnaud that an Irishman's culinary skills ended with boiled potatoes, he was determined to prove him wrong. In 1946, he opened Owen Brennan's Vieux Carré restaurant on Bourbon Street, where Bananas Foster, Breakfast at Brennan's, and History were made in the process. So Bananas Foster was made at Brennan's, and it's still a hoity-toity big restaurant today. Yes. So don't make fun of somebody saying boiled potatoes, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you're Irish, you can only do boiled potatoes. Yeah.
People are creative.
They are. My cat, he keeps, like, thumping my mouse. He's with his tail. Hey, stop it. Why do you keep doing that? Jeez, he's a weirdo. Anyway, another thing in 1946, free lunches became available in schools. A federal law led to the creation of the National School Lunch Program in 1946. The initiative would bring free and low-cost lunches to qualified students in schools across the country.
Nice.
Yeah.
Awesome.
So that was 1946.
Wow, a lot happened.
Yeah.
Like I said, after a big global event.
Yeah. All the soldiers coming home. You gotta feed them soldiers food.
Well, yeah.
Just make sure it's frozen from concentrate. Make sure it's instant potatoes, and you can fry it in a bag. And
but
it's like,
don't spell it with an E.
Yeah, but don't spell it with an E like Dan did. Maybe that's where he went wrong. He was born and he saw potatoes misspelled so many ways. Because all the instant mashed potatoes and all that. He's like, it has an E. And then it nightmares the rest of his life. Poor Dan Quayle. I tell you. But the next time on Plate and Time, we're going to 1934.
Ooh. Oh.
Yeah.
Another bad time.
Another
bad time. Literally halfway through the Depression. So.
Yes. Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Foods. I will try to see what countries were doing well in 1934. I've got a feeling that it's not very many.
Not many. I think there were some that were okay.
Right.
But not many.
Yeah. But otherwise, yes, it will be Depression era foods. Probably ham and beans, cornbread. Oh boy. It's going to be wonderful. Everybody listening to Culinary Convo coming up 1934. Yeah, it's going to be great. But I appreciate my lovely wife, Kaylee.
Yeah, it's fun. Along. It's fun to learn. And
yeah, 1946.
Yeah.
Having some chiwis and going out. And
I'm telling you.
Yeah.
Chiwis probably should have been Cheetos, but.
Yeah. We could have had a mouse.
We could have had a mouse instead. Yeah. Said Chester. I hate that name.
Yeah.
Sorry, any Chesters out there. I don't like the name.
Could have had an Elmer mouse.
I think I like Elmer more than Chester.
Yeah, I agree with you.
So.
Yeah. And the thing is, would you think they would have changed the name or they would have shortened it somehow, do you think? Like Elm? Like Elmer.
No, that's dumb.
Yeah, I don't know.
It's got to be Elmer.
Ooh, but if you made like a jalapeno or a taco season little chiwi, you could call it like Elmer's. Get it? Like E-L and then space Mers. Like Elmer's jalapeno chiwis or something. I'm not in marketing. So I would have been fired. I would have been like Jebediah in 1997, who was going from one place to another, just failing over and over again. I would have been that. Yeah. But anyways, we'll see everybody next time in 1934. Thank you again, Kaylee. And thanks, little Chunk Chunk. Look at him. Oh my gosh. Look at him. He's so
he's like, hey, he's like, where's the chiwis?
Yeah, where's the chiwis? Where's the chiwis? We'll see everybody next time. Goodbye.
Bye.
Everybody, we'll see you in 34.
It's okay.
Depression.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
This episode of Culinary Convo was written, produced, edited, and created by yours truly, Devin Rehm, and is a part of Mouthful Productions. Please check us out on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, at Culinary Convo, and our website, culinaryconvo.com, for recipes, episodes, resources, and send an email to culinaryconvopod@gmail.com with your fan suggestions or recipe submissions. You can also support the podcast by going to anchor.fm/culinaryconvo1/support so we can purchase cooking or audio equipment to help create a better podcast, or by using the funds to help further the exploration of Culinary Convo by ordering subscription boxes, food kits, or ordering food products to review. So shout out to our first supporter, Convonaut Dylan. Thank you. I also want to give audio credit to Soundtrap for our intro, transitions, and outro music. Thank you.